before the dancing, the artistic concentration that he shared with us was visual art. I was going to say that, you know, he sent people to classes. Taj went to a Raku weekend that he paid for. And he
totally
took
forgotten.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I have one of your Raku pieces.
He paid for Zainab to go to the Rudolf Steiner School to art classes, and we went to visit potters, and we went to museums, and the concentration was very much visual art. There were a lot of artists around. Then the dancing came. It turned out there were all these musicians that we didn't even know that there were musicians until Alauddin started the choir that, you know, people like Vashist and Halima, you know, could really sing.
Yeah.
And Moinuddin and Murshid was in the choir at first.
He was in the choir, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, but then that didn't last very long. I was the guitarist.
He wanted to support it.
Here's his dance partner, Rada. Yeah. Rada. Recognize her?
he liked...
And that's what he would do in the dances that very few people have done since. I mean, the dances have spread all over the world. They're a vehicle for a lot of realization in a lot of ways. But he would dare to be Krishna in the dance. He would dare to be Rama in the dance. He had the confidence to be that and to transmit it while he was doing it. And he had the ability to take all these people that were out there, spread out in their consciousness all over the space, and be the magnet that would pull them down into their bodies and to bring them onto earth and to give them a rhythm in their lives. And that's what he was so able to do. And nobody had a clue that you needed to do that.
Taj, tell us a little about becoming his dance partner.
Oh, I did speak about that last night, but for the sake of the project here, I'll just say again that I had a dream. It must have been a dream about Murshid and I and in some kind of loving embrace or something. And he said, he announced, I don't know how he announced it, but he announced that based on that I would be his dance partner, Radha.
But explain how the Radha dance worked. What did he do in the Radha dance? Do you remember?
Oh, help me out because...
don't you remember he had all of these ladies that he was with, each one of his lady disciples?
Well, everybody, of course, became Radha.
When he did the Krishna, I mean?
No, when he did the Radha, then he would go off with Jamila.
My name was Jamila.
Yeah, at the end, because he danced with each one of these gopis who were his... all of his murids, and then he would come to Jamila.
And we would have a Radha Krishna glance, and there was transmitted the whole divine love state, where God becomes two, to experience itself, him or herself. And I was very young and unconscious, and a lot of times I felt the power of that was... overwhelming, and I didn't know how to, you know, fully contain it. It was more like seeds of something that would be that I had taken in that would take all these years to germinate and to fulfill. So it was like a transmission that I was unable at that time to obviously fully comprehend the profound dimensionality of it. I was, of course, honored and touched that I was able to have those dances with him. I think, you know, in retrospect, what an enormous blessing to receive that direct transmission.
But I remember him saying about you as a dance partner that you were the only one that could meet him there where he wanted to, mm-hmm. you know, convey this.
Well, I did sometimes, I have to say.
Yes. Yeah. I'd like to tell one story that gives you another look into his extraordinary personality. He was the most unself-conscious person that I'd ever met. Till today, I've never met someone who simply was just what was arising. I went for my first interview, and you know, where I scheduled, I made an appointment to come see him. And at this time, he was living, he would spend half the week at the Mentor Garden and the other half of the week at the Garden of Inayat, which was a Sufi khanqah, you know, a home where Moinuddin Fatima, Taj and Mansur and Hassan and Jainara and Murshid lived.
And Nathan,
thank you. And he had a small office there, and there was a vegetable garden, and you know, sometimes you'd go and help him work in the garden and things like that. But this time, I wasn't going to help vacuum the house or work in the garden, but for an interview. And knocked at the door. He welcomed me at the door, very welcoming, and so nice of you to come to see me, and walked me into his office, and straight ahead said, "And why did you come to see me?" And so, you know, I said to Murshid, I don't really have any questions. It just felt like I was supposed to come and see you. He stood up, he looked at me, said, "Well, thank you very much for coming," and he walked out. No, I don't know anybody else who would have the nerve, you know, to teach somebody in such a direct way, you know. And he took chances, and you know, the most difficult chance was at least his telling to me of what happened when Moinuddin got sick and then in the hospital. Moinuddin, he had told us throughout our time with him that when he first met Moinuddin, he had a Sufi symbol on his forehead, and he was his successor because he didn't want to have the same history that had happened after Hazrat Inayat Khan's passing, where there wasn't any, you know, demonstrable proof of what Hazrat Inayat Khan's wish was. And so, you know, he announced it all the time. There was no doubt in anyone's mind who was in our family of students that it was Moinuddin, his top disciple, you know, or his main disciple. Moinuddin got sick, you know, he had the beginning of kidney disease, and he was in the hospital, and he was dying. And Murshid said, I didn't visit him. And, you know, also, you can't conceive, how could you not visit your, you know, your chief disciple right away, all, you know, all the time. And he says, then I was called in. And he said, I walked into the hospital room, and I started, and when he told me this story, he imitated himself, but he said, I yelled at him at the top of my lungs. He says, you were there. You want to take it from here, or you want me to tell what he told me?
No, you tell me.
So he said, I started yelling at Moin, and he says, get the hell out of this bed. You think you're going to heaven? You're going straight to hell. You have a mission. You have a family. You know. You want a job in a mattress factory?
No, if you want to stay in bed, get a job in a mattress
factory. Oh, yeah. He says, if you don't get out of this bed, I'm going to come in here and beat you with my Zen stick. And I don't care if the police come in.
And there was a private nurse, this man that was there with him, who was just horrified. I mean, it was just...
But before he went over there, he turned to me in the office, you know, and he had to go over there because he was leaving for New York. And he didn't want Moinuddin to die.
That's where I was.
Moinuddin to die while he was gone. And so he couldn't any longer stay away. So that's why he was called there. But he turned to me and he said, I've got to do the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I've got to go into this hospital and yell at this person I love.
Yeah. That's exactly what he said to me.
Yeah.
He said, that was the hardest thing. It was the hardest assignment I'd gotten in my whole life. And he didn't, you know, it wasn't any, like, discussion. You know, just walked out.
He was in the hospital for 3.5 months.
But he told me, he came back and he said to me, he said, now I got to go. He said, I want you to go in there next week and do the same thing, but not yell at him. Just tell him every positive thing that is going on in this community and then turn around and leave.
I want to give you a sense of how much was going on in a week. Sunday afternoon was the Sunday afternoon dance class. Sunday night was Dharma night. Monday morning, he had started a men's dance class for just a few people that would come to his house in the morning. Monday night was the Sufi meeting. Tuesday, for those of us in the choir, was Sufi choir rehearsal at the Garden of Allah, where some of us lived. Wednesday night was the public dance meeting. Then Thursday night was the Gatha Gita program, usually at the Garden of Anayat. Friday night, for those of us in the Sufi choir, was Sufi choir rehearsal. Saturday afternoon was the Saturday afternoon dance class. And then Saturday night was the Saturday night dance class. And that brings you back to Sunday.
Which was the advanced class you had to qualify to get into.
Yeah. And in between, especially on Sunday, we'd have the afternoon dance class where we did a lot of the astrological walks and different walking practice. And then he liked to cook for us, and he would cook us dinner, and we watched Perry Mason together. He liked to watch Perry Mason.
His favorite salad that he made was it was canned peas and little shrimp with iceberg lettuce.
Oh, I forgot that one.
And just swarming in Thousand Island dressing, which he would make way ahead of time, so it was like soup. It was like soggy, you know, the lettuce had a sog. But I loved it. I mean,
everybody loved it because it had so much love in it. You just couldn't not eat it, you know. I mean, it was just, you know, it was amazing.
Yeah. And I loved canned peas. He was so generous. I mean, he didn't have much money, but he spent everything he had on us.
This is Fatima and I, and these are dresses that he got us.
He had made, there was a Persian store on Polk Street, and he had them specially make these dresses, which were, the only thing Persian about them was they gathered on each leg. But they were kind of low-cut acetate with these huge paisley design. And I think it was highly flammable, actually. Mine burned up. Mine was fuchsia, and hers was blue. Otherwise, they were matching. So wait, there's
him. I had forgotten.
But there also were shoes, which were like leather. I have them. Yeah, embroidered leather, lamb's wool kind of pointy shoes that came with it. So. He used to take us out to dinner all the time. His favorite place, the Chinese restaurant, was the Star View, where they didn't starve you.
Yeah.
What about?
I want to bring it back a little more to the question around the dances and the walks and everything, because it was really a serious thing to want to get into that Saturday night dance class. You had to pass one of the astrological walks to get in there. I mean, and he didn't pass you easily on something, you know. You had to master it. You had to get it. And then you could get in. And, I mean, he was that way. He didn't mind setting a hurdle for somebody, you know, and we'd give somebody a practice to do, and then they want to do this thing, and this thing, this thing, and this thing, this thing. And you just always keep bringing them back. Well, how are you done with that concentration on the, you know, triangle? You know, oh, well, I haven't been there. Yeah, well, okay, that's the one. You know, I mean, all this rest, but this is happening in this dream. I don't know, what about this? You know, so he had this sense of setting us, because then you would walk around, you know, I mean, and the question is, how is he going to look at you? I mean, could you pass it or not? I mean, because you were very self-conscious around. A lot of people were very self-conscious around him because he had so to be able to be. Not self-conscious and just be around him, you know, he'd already set up a kind of a threshold that you had to get across. The way to do it was to work, you know, to do something, to go over there and actually be doing. I learned that, you know, I get my hand in the dishes, I'd wash them, I'd take out the garbage, whatever. You know, I got started, you know, I went over there because you were complaining all the time, there's nobody to help me, nobody to help me. They come to my classes, but where's the help? So that's how I got close to him. I went over there and I started helping him. And then, you know.
I did too, but yeah. We didn't do much work. I mean, we were there, though, but we'd go for walks. But you brought your chart to the class, and you would do the walk of your trines and your, you know, and the opposites.
Well, he would look at it, and he would decide about a karma walk and a dharma walk for people.
Yeah.
So. I don't know about you guys, but I feel that the Saturday night dance class somehow that seemed to be the densest teaching,
mm-hmm.
Other than personally picking up from him but being around him. But that seemed like there was such concentration in the Saturday night class that there was so much given there, so much teaching.
Yeah, it was. That was the, yeah, I think so too.
Receiving the intense transmission.
And it was in a garage with an oil stained cement floor.
I think we put a rug down or something, but no, we didn't.
Not at first.
Right away. It's, now beautiful. It's our beautiful meeting room now.
And it wasn't, you know, sheetrocked or lined or anything. It was just a garage. Mm-hmm. We
but
were
it
in
felt
the garage.
Boundless.
Yeah.
When we did the walks.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like there were any walls. It felt like we were in
That's
space.
Where he gave all these walks and all the astrological walks, all the tarot walks, all the walks of the prophets, everything.
And the new dances.
And all the new dances, that's where he would bring them first. And
how many people would be there?
25.
How did the Manta Garden get in the picture? How did that happen?
Well, I don't know how he found it, because I met him shortly after he moved.
He shared
there,
it with
With Mr. Hunt, who was an artist. And then when all these young people kept coming over more and more and more.
He didn't own it. We only purchased it after his passing.
No.
And, yeah, that's right. No, he rented it, and after his accident, you know, he fell down the stairs and he got a deep brain concussion, brain injury. And then, you know, from the hospital point of view, he was never out of a coma. But from our point of view, he came out and was very lucid. He dictated several letters. People would come over, and sometimes he would say something, you know.
Or bite someone.
Yeah, right.
Or kiss someone.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, you know, but he did pull himself together to write this last letter to Sufi Barkat Ali, who was his living teacher.
And I was there when Joe Miller came, and he kept saying, take it. Take it. It was squeezing his hand. Take it.
I was sleeping at the Mentor Garden. It was because I stayed over Sunday night because Monday morning was the men's dance class. I slept in the front room. Halim Welch was there. You lived there.
Mm-hmm.
Saul lived up the hill, Saul Baradovsky.
I still remember that thud, yeah.
And I slept through the thud, but I had the car. And it wasn't my car, it was Iqbal's car, because he was in Jerusalem doing a retreat. And so he had loaned me his car, a yellow Chevy Impala convertible, you know, with a black top and yellow. And so Halim woke me up and said, we need the keys to your car. Murshid fell down the stairs. Well, obviously I didn't give him the keys, but I got up. And we put Murshid in the car to drive him over to San Francisco General. And he wasn't lucid at that point. What I remember him was reciting again and again. There's a line in the prayer, all-powerful creator. And so he's going like this, all-powerful creator, all-powerful creator, all-powerful creator, all-powerful creator. And we drove to San Francisco General, which was really a dive. And Wali Ali and Halim went to register, with the ER to get him in. It wasn't the same kind of setup you have in a hospital today. And so that left Saul and I with Murshid, now on a gurney. And he wasn't exactly, you know, calm. He wanted to get out of his body. And so we had him pinned, if you can imagine pinning your teacher to the gurney. I had his legs pinned, and Saul had his arms pinned. You know, so there was kind of where he'd come lucid and unlucid, and he'd say, "What the hell are we doing here?" You know, and then Saul would start to say, "I said, shut up! What are we doing here?" You know, and then Saul would say something, and at one point, somehow Saul must have loosened his grip, and his arm went flying. Hit him clean in the face, you know. And then I remember we took him up to the room to be x-rayed, and it like ripped the thing that was holding him in play.
He was kind of, strong.
He was very, very strong. And, and then we had it set up where the ER then was kind of like a one big room like this with, you know, 20 beds in it. You know, it was kind of like old army style. And an award.
The intensive care reminded me of something from the Civil War.
Yeah.
After being at UC with Moynihan, it was this giant room with these beds.
But they did allow us to have two Marines with him, 24 hours a day, and that's when so many things happened.
Yeah, well, when I showed up there, he said, "Why aren't you minding the house? What are you doing here? You should be at home taking care of the place." So I took that, to have a meeting, because shortly after he did die, we had take care of the place. I mean, just do the work that you were doing. You know what your assignments were. But then we got evicted. And Saul and I went down to find somebody that could help us, and he charmed the guy, and then we bought the house. But the only person who had a job that could afford to go, whose name could go on, we could pay for it, all right, but nobody had a job,
No one could get proper credit.
No one could get a bank loan, except for Alauddin Matthew and his wife. So they're the ones that went on the deed for the Minta Garden. Okay. But it was like there were a lot of cryptic messages that people felt they got from him at that point in time. And then he became totally lucid and dictated that last letter, which Saul was there and Daniel Lomax was there.
I heard the story, Daniel had moved to Tucson to start the first satellite, center. And Mercy was scheduled to go there later in January. And so he walked into the hospital room, and Mercy sat up in bed and looked at Daniel and said, "What the hell are you doing here? You're supposed to be in Tucson." And so to have a quick response, he had grown a long beard and long hair to blend in with us. And he had a hairbrush in his hand.
He wrote me once. He said he didn't look. He looked in the mirror and he didn't recognize
didn't
feel
himself.
Like himself.
Because he had a beard. Yeah.
So he's got the hairbrush and he says, "Well, Mercer, I came to brush your hair." And he says, "I ought to brush the inside of your head." And then he said, and he had been previous to Wally Ali and Mansour, he had been one of his, Daniel had been one of his secretaries.
Yeah.
And so it was very natural that he would dictate this letter to Daniel. And he said, "Take down this letter." And then he handed out, we all got a copy of that letter within, no time. And reading the letter, it wasn't clear that he was going. He said, "I will live on indefinitely as God wills." And then on the other paragraph, he said,
"This is one of,
he's already gone.
One of the most glorious exits in history or something,
right.
Or something like that." But it was,
but
he said, basically, "I fulfill my mission," is what he said in that letter. I was able to do it. I was able to fulfill.
He fell on December 27th.
Mm-hmm. It was a Monday.
And on December 25th, Mary Ben had given him for Christmas some strawberry yogurt shampoo. And he opened it up and he looked at it and he said, "Too late." He said, "I already washed my hair." And it was true.
Talking about eerie things like that, when Daniel was his secretary, he had this, several fights with Mercer because Daniel was very determined. This one was about wanting Mercer to get Social Security. And Mercer said, I can't get Social Security. I'm not getting Social Security. There's no Social Security." Now Daniel, Daniel was researching it and he was looking at all the details. He says, I'm not going to get Social Security. You're wasting my time. I'm going to get Social Security. And Daniel said, it looks to me like, And so he went ahead and he filled it out. And after Mercer died a few days later, he got the Social Security thing that came in.
Really, he didn't get it while he was alive?
No, he never got it. He never got Social Security, but after he was, it came later.
But he used to, people would call him up and say, you can come get, you get a free camera if you have your picture taken or something. He'd go for all that stuff. We'd tell him, it's a scam. But he'd go for that. The one with the picture with the hat on that we all see, that was one of those. He's got this little plastic 35mm camera, but
back to the dances.
He always was trusting.
He said to us many times that these dances would go around the world, and that he would be, every year he was gone, he would be more exponentially famous, and these dances would spread exponentially. And so, as deeply moved by the fact of the spread of the dances as we are, it didn't come as a surprise at all. I mean, it was something he had said to us.
And he kept saying, don't put me on a pedestal. Don't put me on a pedestal. And I'm like,
whoever would.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I don't, you know. But, yeah, right. I don't.
Yeah, you see.
Don't put me on a pedestal.
But you never know what a person's influence will be. Because, we're talking about Hasrei Nayat Khan and all these lineages, but Abraham just had someone come from Colombia to his house. You know, they're teaching in South America. And in Boston and Cambridge. And the person came in and saw the big picture of Hasrei Nayat Khan on the altar and said, what is he doing here? This was someone from the Awaska Church. They have a whole hymn book, and he's one of their deities, and they say these prayers to him during their Awaska ceremonies and so forth. You know, I mean, I was telling Pierce about this. He thought it was so, you know, wild, you know. I mean, these dances, I mean, they're just, I mean, things, when there's a certain power that is in, they're, it goes, it moves, and it doesn't necessarily move through just the channels you expect.
Abraham's name was Roy, and he was at the New Hampshire Ram Dass experiment with me, we were together at Ram Dass's experiment, and like Fatima said, whenever you had a friend, you wanted to bring them to your teacher, and then you would hope they liked your teacher. I mean,
he hopefully was on his good behavior.
Yeah, right.
So here's the experience.
Or not.
Here's the experience for Abraham, who is Roy. Roy Sussman. And he comes into the Mentor Garden. And as Wally Ali said the other night, he said, the first thing you do is this big energy would hit you. So, you know, you'd sit down in the doorway. And the first thing he would say, don't block the doorway. So right away, you know, he didn't say, could you please not sit in the doorway? You know, there was this kind of jarring influence. So Abraham was sitting, and I still kind of visualize where he was sitting over here. Murshid was in the front. And he was very cordial in another way. When someone was new in the room, he'd go around and say, hello, what's your name? Welcome, and what's your name? And he said, my name is Roy, and Roy Sussman. And he says, and where do you live? So now this was in Abraham's mind, this was the cosmic test. And so he took some time, and he says, I live in the cosmos. So Murshid says to him, no, I said, where do you live? So he still thinks it's a cosmic, says, the universe. And now Murshid's getting, he's getting louder, and he says, I said, where do you live? You know, and this went on, this banter went back and forth. And then finally, Abraham says, in my Volkswagen bus. He says, thank you very much.
And another thing.
He became his disciple.
Yeah. He said,
a loyal disciple.
He said, the only excuse for missing a meeting was to make money. And I said, that's the kind of statement, you know, 2,000 years, you know, later, you know, they'd say it was for a bunch of hippies and nobody had a job. So it was actually to Mansur who didn't think he could miss a meeting, but he had a job, you know. And so Murshid said, the only excuse for missing a spiritual meeting is to make money.
He took people and now people are immensely successful. It's amazing. He drew people down. He gave us a rhythm for our life. And then all of a sudden, people were immensely successful in every field.
Well, did everything backwards, though. Yeah. Usually, you have a career, family, and then you go on the spiritual path. We were on the spiritual path, then we had a family, and then, whoops, no career. That was the last thing.
And we started this talking about psychedelics, and naturally it was a time of psychedelics and botanicals. But my own experience was that I couldn't go to any meeting intoxicated because it was too much to take. So from the time he wisely never spoke out against botanicals and chemicals, but he said, I'm going to have a program that you can have joy without drugs, you know. But he was also very careful. He said he didn't like the word drugs because he thought it was very unscientific. And so he said, I have a few rules in my house. No-dos and no aspirins and no-dos. Can't have drugs here. Except for one person, he never stopped anybody from using psychedelics or botanicals. But I didn't have the capacity to go there, Stone. So it just fell away. He, as far as I know, Ayesha was the only one he told, don't smoke anymore. You know?
Yeah, but he was, you know, he was just higher than that. I mean, that was the thing. That was like what Ram Dass found out when he went to his teacher. You know, I mean, that he was beyond that. But he said all these people are putting all these people down. He says they're having real experiences. You know, and he was there for us and. You know, that was just his practical nature. He said these things need to be studied scientifically. You know, what are the actual effects of these? These are herbs. These, let's look at them. You know, so much of this is just social. Tomatoes, he said, used to be, you know, verboten.
We gave him a pot brownie once.
Yeah.
No effect whatsoever.
He was beyond all that. I mean, I came there totally in this state, which I described. I'm coming there, you know. I mean, and man, he was like the sober person in the room. I mean, he was like, boom. I mean, you know, he was beyond all that.
Although he did listen to the whole song of Fool on the Hill with stereo headphones.
With the brownie or not?
Yeah, with the brownie, but.
But no, it was an era of psychedelics. I'm sorry, you know, Morali was here, you know, really, because, you know, it was kind of embarrassing for me.
I have one more question, maybe for the two of you who lived with him at the Garden of Anayat. Or Taj, do you have any memories of what it was like living with him?
I couldn't wait for him to go back to the city.
Sometimes. Well, I was eagerly waiting for him.
It was just so intense. I mean, it was... One time, we had a lot of big parties and dance parties, and there's the one where, you know, he had maypoles set up streamers, you know, so we did the dances with maypoles. I mean, it was really something. This was photographed, actually, by the local paper. So he had, in the garden, he had grown this lettuce, and he wanted me to put it in these cheese sandwiches for everyone. Where's that picture? Oh, anyway. So it was the most bitter, awful, bug-eaten, brown, thick lettuce I had ever had in my life. And so I didn't put it in the sandwiches. And he yelled at me. He said, I told you to put it in the sandwiches. I said, but Mershad, it's like, it's awful. And he said, it's the baraka that counts.
Well, yeah, I mean, I never will forget him describing to Pierre Vilayet about how he received the baraka from some sheikh, probably in Pakistan, where they're, you know, the terrorists are today, you know. Sheikh Abdul Aziz, who gave it to him by spitting the food out of his mouth, and he caught it in his mouth. You know, and I remember people out saying, "Really?" You know, and yes, but the baraka, you know, I mean,
right. And I got the baraka of the earwigs and aphids and snails in the food he made for me.
Yeah, so, you noticed. I mean,
I said, "You're right," because once I found one, I. Really you kicked through. Nobody else looked, but he used to grow chard in the garden, and he'd wash it, like, just, you know, big bunch of chard. It's filthy and stuff. He'd just swish it under the faucet, and then he'd cut it up and put it in the eggs. And the funniest part was when somebody came over, and he's going to give this person a lesson in how to wash chard.
But you know, on the one hand, he could exaggerate, but. When he saw things, it was as if he was looking at what they would become, and you know, he was describing, I remember him describing the gardens at the Garden of Anine. He says, and that damned fig tree, it had so many figs we couldn't pick them all. And I went there, it was like three, you know.
But, you know, well, those are the ones who are the left. They couldn't pick them all.
Living with him was like looking in a mirror and seeing your perfection. That's what he reflected back to people, is your, you know, the high, your higher being. And he did that. It was just like a mirror. And that was what was so amazing.
Beautiful. I think that's a good note to,
let's
to close on.
Thank you.
And thank you for giving us this opportunity. And all love and blessings to the dance community that will hear some of this stories. Thank you so much.